glad you're here. We won't be going over the midterm again tonight because I still have two of your colleagues who have to take it. They were supposed to take it this week. And hopefully they will get it done. We'll go through it in depth next week for you. As I said, you needn't worry too much about it because all of you did exceptionally well. For those of you who wanted to get a better grade, that's in your own measure of yourself. Please know that there's extra credit available. We passed out sheets last week. There's more available if you need to. Come up with an idea, and as long as it kind of touches on the law, we're good with it. You can turn around and watch a court case. You can go see the state legislature. You can turn around and write a little paper. I don't like big papers. 3 to 5 pages makes me a stack. Okay. Don't do it in 46 point type, but that's good enough for me. Okay? And we will bump you up significantly if you write such a paper. Go see something in the law. I want you to take your own initiative on this. That's why I don't assign what you have to do. Because that way you can do something that's fun for you. Okay? Any questions on this? Yes. Speak up, please.
Paper, that's online too. The paper sheet for it.
Yes, it's online. It should be. If it's not, please email me. Okay, it should be on the extra credit form for 321. I myself have had a rather busy week. This week, the New York State Legislature, together with the governor, put together an executive and legislative budget together. I have a 55-hour marathon going through just on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday alone. I'm starting to think I'm getting too old for this. Without sleep. Then we turn around on Monday, do another 20-hour day. That's a long day for somebody. Anyway, I just had my 50th birthday on March 7th, so I'm getting kind of long in the tooth for this one. There. The New York State budget is $134 billion. And one of the things that we did that might be of interest to you is we also expanded the SUNY 2020 program. So there's going to be more opportunities at SUNY institutions, giving them literally billions of dollars over the next 5 years. Governor Rockefeller created the SUNY system. It existed before that as the state colleges. This was the Albany State College. Originally was the Albany State College for Teachers. And now we have a state university system, which is literally the envy of the world, but it could use some more money, as all things can. And the SUNY 2020 program has been advanced. So that's a good thing. That's going to be there. You're also going to get more full-time professors as a result of this, because there's some dedication of 25% of the money for that. Hopefully it'll help curb tuition costs in the long run, too. Believe me, I love that just because of the fact that I'm paying them for my daughter. So, anyway, we're going to have a little bit of fun tonight. In addition to our lecture, I'm going to do, if you want, you can raise your hand. How many want to hear what you have to do when you get a traffic ticket? Raise your hand, Drew. I will go through on how we have to deal with that and hopefully help you out on how you can address that. I was in Dublin Town Court a few weeks ago representing my secretary, who happens to have a rather heavy foot. She does an awful lot for me, so I did a little pro bono for her representing them. And I noticed in Dublin Town Court that there were a number of your classmates there visiting the town court. So I figured I might spread a little bit of legal love on you and tell you what you might want to do if one of New York's finest happens to pull you over on the roadside. Anyway, okay. Let's talk about tonight, where we're going to go. How are you doing? Happy girl? All right. Corporations, we're going to do some more on corporations tonight. Last time, we talked about shareholder rights. When you're a shareholder, what does that mean? You have stock in the corporation. Why do they call it a shareholder? Anybody remember? Anybody? Thank you. Yes, Chad. Yeah, what does that interest call? A share, right? What is called a share, right? You're holding a share of the corporation. Words have meaning. Very good. Just like you're taught to play well with others in grade school, you talk to share, well, you share in a corporation. How do you shout at them? Where's the stuff from? At the end of the day, a shareholder is a person who owns a share in the corporation. Okay? That's what its name comes from. You own stock in it. We talked about the acquisition of shares. Remember, you can buy shares by subscription. Anybody remember what that is? What happens when you subscribe? Anybody? Where does subscription shares come from? Come on, guys. Anybody? Nope. When you subscribe to a magazine, where do you get it from? Correct! The company that makes it, right? So when you subscribe to shares, where do you get the shares from? Exactly! When you subscribe to the share, this is not tricky, I promise. You try not to trick it. Okay? When you subscribe to the shares, you get them from the company. They issue them to you directly. Okay? You can also get them by trading them. Any of you used to have baseball cards or football cards as a kid? You trade them. Well, they do the same thing with shares. Once you get them, you can turn around and sell them. The New York Stock Exchange is a place where you can do that. You go to a broker, they go to the exchange, and they turn around, they can trade shares. You can buy them off that exchange. That's after they've been subscribed. Okay? We talked last time about the rights of shareholders. When you have a share in a corporation, it comes with certain rights. When you own common stock, what's the number one principal right that you have? Anybody? Vote, right? Gives you the right to vote. Gives you the right to vote on the board of directors. Okay, the people who run the corporation. Get the ability to elect them. And remember, your vote is generally based on the number of shares you hold. So if you own 50,000 shares, you get 50,000 votes. Works that way. That way you can control the corporation. Because the person who controls the board of directors controls the corporation. You get to tell them what to do. You put in place the people that you want to do your bidding. So if you turn around and have the right to vote, you have the right to control the corporation. Okay? What's another right you have as a shareholder? Anybody remember? Right to distribution. If the company goes out of business, you get the assets. If it's got any money left over, you also have the right of dividends. Remember, if the company gets a profit, it can declare a dividend and share its profits with you. Okay? What are the liabilities of a shareholder? Generally, your liability as a shareholder is limited to the amount that you invested in. If you paid $50 for the share, you're not going to lose more than that $50. That's the very concept of limited liability, which is modern corporate law. It's an incentive
to get people to invest in the company. If you thought that you were going to, when you were going to invest, like you did in ancient times, that you were going to be responsible for all the debts of the company, you might not give the money over because you'd say, I put too much at risk. But the concept of limited liability allows you to take that chance. Saying, hey, I'll buy that stock for $50 a share because it might someday turn out to be worth $2,000. So you'll take the risk. That's one of the ways that corporations generate money, not just by sale of items, but by sale of their stock. And as a result of that, your liability as a shareholder is generally limited. There are exceptions. Remember, if you can pierce the corporate veil. If you are using the corporate entity for fraud, I turn around and form Bob's Donuts, not to run a donut company, but that I could put my house and my car in the corporation and avoid my creditors. Guess what? You're not going to be allowed to do that, and they'll do what they say, pierce the corporate veil. They'll turn around and say that corporation's a sham. You, Bob, as the sole investor, are going to be responsible to those creditors. Okay? Certain other items are also beyond the scope of limited liability. If your corporation goes out of business and you've had wage claims under certain federal statutes, you could end up being liable for that. Okay? Okay. We also talked last time about securities regulation. Remember, we want, this all came out of the 1929 stock market crash. I shouldn't say all, because the Martin Act was actually predated that, 1921. The Martin Act is the state regulation of securities. It is a New York State statute, the most advanced security statute in the country. Authorizes the Attorney General of the state of New York to regulate these securities. But most securities regulation is actually done through the Securities and Exchange Commission, through two acts that were done, remember the 1933 Act and the 1934 Act. Those two acts turn around and regulate two things. First, transparency, so that when you're buying a share of stock, you know what you're buying it in, so it's not fraud or speculative. And secondly, it provides the rules on exchanging stocks, with like on the stock exchange, when you trade them, if it's publicly traded, it regulates them to make sure that that is a fair and honest trade. What was happening in 1929, apparently, was there were a lot of not so fair and honest trades, and this helps regulate to do that. So things like insider trading are against the law. Okay? All right. Lastly, we talked a little bit about industry self-regulating. As we talked last time, that's really not regulation. It's just really good business practice that they're doing to protect their shareholders. And remember, as a board of director, you want your shareholders happy. Why? Why as a director? Chaz? Exactly. Rule number one is anybody who's in elected office, keep those constituents happy, because if they're not happy, you don't have a job. They'll vote you out of office. Okay? So with respect to industry self-regulation, as the textbook talks about it, by and large, what you're trying to do is just good corporate practices to make sure that your investors are happy with you. Okay? All right. Tonight, we're going to talk about two things. We're going to talk about the management of corporations. We're going to talk about a little bit about corporate liability and malpractice. Relates to Sarbanes-Oxley and with respect to accounts liability. Talk a little bit about that. Then we'll finish up real quick about how to address a trap. Okay, that's a little bit of fun. Okay. Corporate management. You form a corporation out there. Bob Stoltz.
what happens? How do you govern the way that that corporation operates? Now remember, corporations are people under the law, right?
Right? They're a special entity.
And as a result of that, because they're people under the law, they can't operate themselves. When you're a partner, the partners operate the partnership, right? But with a corporation, it's got to operate through agents and employees. It has its own existence, but it's an artificial person. No corporation is ever going to walk up and shake hands with you. Its employees, agents, and directors and officers will, but at the end of the day, it doesn't. So we have to form a structure in which it's operating through these agents and employees. Okay? That's called corporate governance. In the last 10 years, there's been a ton of legal articles written on corporate governance. There's a very famous man by the name of Ira Milstein from New York City who's like the guru of corporate governance. How many people you ought to have on a board, what their ethical background should be. A lot of discussions, because in the most recent corporate governance scandals surrounding companies like WorldCom and Enron, a lot of corporate governance issues were discovered. In the late 1990s, you had a lot of mergers of corporations. The economy was transforming, in large part, not exclusively, but due to the fact that you have the global marketplace on the internet now. Real technology drives us to a certain degree. And because of those mergers and acquisitions, you had a lot of corporate boards doing very advanced things, and they see that the law has to pick up to adjust to that. Okay. A corporation, in acting through its employees, acting through its agents, okay, becomes the entity that drives it. Who are these people? Who are the people who drive a corporation, who control it? We just talked about shareholders. They're the ultimate people because they're the owners of the corporation. Everything that a corporation does occurs on behalf of those shareholders. A corporation exists for the shareholders. It doesn't exist to do good work. We've had some discussion on that this past year with respect to some of those people who are camping out in parks and things like that. The purpose of a corporation, and we're talking about a business corporation, is to only serve the interests of the shareholders. They have a legal responsibility. It's created for the shareholders, and its legal purposes are to serve them, and serve them only. They are the governing body of them. It is a republican form of governance. And when we say that, that has a legal term of art. The republican form of governance means what? Who can tell me that? Anybody? Yes. Exactly. Thank you, Ben. You elect the boards of directors. The shareholders are the constituents. The boards of directors are the government. And that Republican form means the shareholders don't directly vote on things. You don't put up a vote as to whether or not Nabisco is going to sell a product. You don't put up a vote over whether or not you're going to double sell Oreos. Okay? What you do is you elect a board of directors who then turn around and make those decisions. The board of directors is the government of a corporation. Okay? And it is structured as that. So who are these boards of directors? They are generally people, particularly in the early area, who form the corporation, or after a corporation matures after several years, they're people who are elected based on the replacement of that role. They are not the people who do day-to-day operations of the corporation. They are the governing body of it. The people who do the day-to-day operations, who are the top of the food chain of a corporation, are the officers. That is the president, the
vice president, the secretary. Those are the people who make the ultimate decisions. A board of directors is like a government. They, one of their roles is to hire the officers. So unless you have an officer we can rely on, the board of directors is going to pick a new one. They serve at the pleasure of the board of directors. If a president of a company wants to be elected, he's not elected, he's selected by the board. The board votes on that person. It's not a campaign. It's a hiring. A president, the officers are employees of the corporation. Board of directors are not generally employees. They can be because they can serve in dual capacities, but they're generally not. That being said, you generally get a salary, or actually it's called a stipend, for serving as a board of director. If I sit on the board of Trustco Bank, you're going to pay me some amount of money every year to serve on that board. There's liability you can have as being a member of the board of directors. Because not only, remember, can the shareholders vote you out of office, but they can also turn around and sue you. That's called the shareholder derivative act. So most people do not serve on public boards gratuitously. They get paid for it, but they get paid a fraction of what the officers get paid for, because they'll generally only meet a handful of times a year, sometimes quarterly, sometimes monthly, sometimes bi-monthly, but most often monthly. So you meet 12 times a year, make the general broad policy decisions, direct the officers on what to do, and get your stipend for doing it. The bigger the company, the bigger the stipend. If you're on the board of directors of Bob Donuts, you'll probably get a few donuts. If you're on the board of directors of Union Carbide or Microsoft, you're going to get a very big stipend. Okay? It's related to the size of the organization because your liability is related to that. Now, boards of directors often buy insurance for that reason. So if you make a mistake and you get sued, there's insurance to cover. The officers, remember, they are a day-to-day person hired for the top of the food chain of the employees of the corporation. Okay? They, under the law of agency, are given the authority to operate and do the bidding of the board of directors. That's what their role is. Okay? They are the ones who sign the contracts. They are the ones who go into agreements with other parties. They carry out the day-to-day operations of the business. They're the ones who hire and fire the other employees. They are the management, top management, of the corporation. Officers are the ones who make the corporation go. Board of directors do long-term goals. They hire the officers. They are the governing body. Okay? Officers, operations, board of directors, government. Okay? Okay. Very often, board of directors can be officers, particularly the smaller the corporation. Remember I mentioned Ira Milstein. He was one of the persons who came up with a lot of reforms for corporate governance. One of the things he says is, to prevent conflicts of interest, you shouldn't have boards of directors also be officers. He doesn't believe in that.
And certain states have precluded that, particularly with certain types of corporations. That being said, most states do not, particularly with small corporations, some of these things are determined on size. Particularly with small corporations, when you have three or four investors, somebody trying to start a business, you know, you're the board of directors, you're the president, you're the secretary, you make the donuts, you do everything. Guess what? Those rules don't apply. But when you're talking about something like GM, IBM, Microsoft, big corporations, most people do follow, most corporations do follow the Milstein model and separate the board from the officers. Okay. In addition to hiring the officers, one of the things that the board of directors does is they create strategic plans. These things are frequently 5 or multiple-year plans on which they give direction for the officers. Generally, boards of directors vote on what the officers prepare for them. The way a board of directors meeting works is the officers of the corporation will prepare things to vote on by the board of directors. So if you have Oreo Cookie Company wants to buy Chips Ahoy, they'll prepare for the board of directors a merger agreement, which they'll vote on to turn around and buy that, or an acquisition agreement. If all of a sudden they want to turn around and redesign the Oreo cookie and say, let's put the stuffing on the outside, okay? Let's turn around and drive a three-wheel car instead of a two-wheel motorcycle. Those items are going to be presented by the officers with background material for the board to approve. Officers generally do not make policy-based decisions on their own. They make administrative decisions. When I say administrative decisions, who is going to be the head of the district office in Milwaukee? That will be a decision for an office. Whether or not they open a district office in Milwaukee, a policy decision will be determined by the board, as presented by those officers. Okay? There's a bifurcation, a separation between the two. Okay? Now, how many boards of director? How many board members do you have on a board of directors? Anybody know how that number is divided? Because there's no magic number, although if you talk to Mr. Milstein, he always says 7. He says more than 7 is too big, less than 7 is too small. Goldilocks. Right. How many? You can have a board of directors any size you want. How is that determined? Anybody know? Take a guess. Take it. How do you come up with a number of board of directors? Sorry? Kind of, but how specific?
So can you guess the number of shareholders?
Sorry?
The number of shareholders?
Nope. When you create a corporation, what do you draft? An articles of incorporation. Remember, it's kind of like the constitution of a corporation. When you file an article of incorporation, contained within that article is the number of board of directors. So if you want to change the number of boards of directors, and you can do that, you have to change your articles of incorporation. And that's done by a vote of, guess who? The board of directors. Okay. So if you want to change the number of people that are on it, that is up to the board of directors. But the board of directors who serve on it, that's up to the shareholders, because they have to be voted on. Okay. Generally, courts will not interfere with decisions of board of directors that are done in the absence of conflict of interest. So
So if a board of directors makes a decision to turn around and start manufacturing three-wheeled motorcycles, guess what? A shareholder turns around and says, that's the stupidest idea I ever heard of, and I don't want you to do that. They won't follow that. They won't agree with them. Now, if one of the board of directors happens to own an interest in the largest three-wheeled motorcycle manufacturing plant in the free world and wants to sell the parts on that to the corporation, suddenly there's a conflict of interest there. Because he's going to benefit or she's going to benefit from that decision. Then you have an argument. But absent a conflict of interest where one of the board members has an interest in what they are doing, particularly fiduciary interest, meaning financial interest, absent that, courts will not stop that. So if the board of directors of General Motors decides they want to vote to make a car that runs on algae, they can do it, even if it's unproven and unplanned. Okay? It's up to the board. If the shareholders don't like what they're doing, they can vote them out of office. Okay. Directors have the authority, as we said, to manage the corporations. They may enter into contracts. Remember, the contracts are drafted and negotiated by the officers. They're even signed by the officers. But they're approved by, ratified, and approved by the board. Okay? They appoint the officers. They appoint members of the executive committees. Boards of directors can have individual committees. Frequently, one of the things that is popular to have now is an audit committee. A committee of the board of directors that looks at the audits and financial health of the company that reports back to the main board of directors. Milstein loves audit committees, thinks they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. Generally, the audit committee is always, I shouldn't say always, but more frequently than not, headed up by an accountant. Makes sense. They're the ones who know about audits. But at the end of the day, if you only have one accountant on your board, the same person is always going to be the head of the audit committee, right? Kind of like when they have a legal committee, they'll ask the lawyer, right? So as a result of that, you may not be getting a divergence of opinion if you might want. So audit committees may be a more limited utility than Mr. Milstein thinks. I don't mean to pick on him, because he is the world expert. He thinks of things about corporate governance that most of us don't do in our school. We've talked about a little bit about the liability directors. They have to operate in a fiduciary capacity. What does that mean? Everybody knows that they have an interest to protect the finances of the shareholders. They have a duty of loyalty to the shareholders to make sure that the shareholders get a maximum profit on their share, that the corporation does well. They have a financial responsibility to the shareholders. That is their number one job. Because the corporation is a business for profit. It does not operate out of the goodness of its heart. It operates for one exclusive purpose, and that is to make money in the business that they're doing. Shareholders can sue you if you're not doing that. They can vote you out of office on it. So directors can actually be held liable for the failure to make profits in their business. There is a rule under the law. It's known as the business judgment rule. It's a defense for the directors who act in good faith. Take the example I just used about GM turning around and trying to make a car that runs on algae. Yes, it may be a very risky idea, but the payoffs may be high. So what the boards of directors who approve it would argue is they would say, look it, we have an opportunity to take some risk, but the reward potential is very high on it. Okay. $5 a gallon of gasoline, people want to put some sort of plant life in your tank. Could be a possibility.
So if that does go south, all of a sudden they find this huge oil reserve under New Mexico or something, start to pump it out like crazy, guess what? All of a sudden nobody wants an LG car, and GM has problems. Could they be sued? Yeah, you could sue anybody for any reason, any time, but what this would allow is say, we used our best judgment, we took an educated risk, we lost on it, not all risks win, so as a result of that, we turned around and made our best guess. Did you have a question? No? Just stretching? Good thing. Around 4 a.m.
on Sunday morning, I left my office in the Capitol, just walking around the Capitol, and there was a young lady going like this, all over the place. I said, are we a little bit tired? She says, it's 4 in the morning on Sunday. What do you think? So they were stretching to leave. Okay.
Officers, agents, and employees. Remember, these are the people who make the corporation go. Officers of a corporation, including the CEO. What does CEO stand for? Chief Executive Officer. You have two O's in corporations. You have the CEO, Chief Executive Officer. That is the top banana. They're the people who direct things. They report to the chairman of the board.
Chairman of the board, remember, is the head guy of the board. The board elects chairman. He's the one, or she's the one, that conducts the meetings of the board of directors.
CEO is the top employment officerial position in corporation.
Okay. Usually it's CEO, then the president. Where you don't have a CEO, you'll have the president. Okay? Chief Executive Officer, then you'll have a president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer.
Often today you also will have a CFO.
Where you don't have a CFO, you just default to the treasurer, but a CFO is a chief financial officer. Okay? Those are the two big people in a corporation. And under Sarbanes-Oxley, which we talked about the last time, those are the people who have to swear that the accuracy of the reports, you've got to do an annual report, quarterly reports to your corporation, CEOs and CFOs are the people who have to sign them. You can also employ agents of the corporation as well as employees. And remember, agents are much more of an independent contractorial position. Okay? An agent can also be deemed to be an employee, but by and large, agents are much more temporary when you're dealing with an agent for a corporation than doing a project-based agency, usually on a contract. Okay? Employees are just that. You work and push shopping carts for Price Chopper, you're an employee of Price Chopper. Okay? Turn around and work for Bob's Donuts, Bacon Donuts, you're an employee for that corporation. Okay? Relations with the corporations, as we discussed, are fiduciary in nature. That being said, the lower you are on the food chain, the less your fiduciary duty is. If you are an employee pushing shopping carts, the likelihood that they're going to hold you responsible for the profit of the supermarket owner is not so high. If you are the CEO of the corporation, the shareholders take a different perspective. Okay? The higher up you are on the food chain, the more responsible you are. And officers are not only responsible to shareholders, but they're responsible also to the board. So they get it coming up and they get it coming down. Officers being the middle management that they are, they have two sets of bosses. They have the shareholders and they have the boards of directors. Okay? Okay. The number one question in determining whether someone is liable, and again, officers also purchase liability insurance, but the number one question you have to ask on liability is, did that officer or director breach a duty of fiduciary duty to the sheriff? Did they do something wrong? It's not enough that their actions did not maximize the profit. Because if we all knew the answer on how to maximize profits, we'd all be pretty wealthy people. You have to, in our capitalist system, you have to take risks, you have to take gamble, and you weigh that, you manage it. Good corporate officers come out more often than not that they turn around and manage the corporation to make a profit. And it is managed. Okay? But if you breach your fiduciary duty, if you turn around and head the company south because of conflict of interest, you will be sued and held responsible. You could also be thrown out of office, more likely than not. Directors and officers are not held generally responsible for debts or obligations of the corporation. If a corporation takes a gamble and loses a lot of money, generally, as long as they're following standard business practices, the people who lost the money, whether it be shareholders or the people who hold the obligations, if they took out loans or other debt, are not going to be able to recover it from it. The very nature of a corporation is limited liability. It's why it's formed. And they're not going to hold their employees or the board of directors, remember, officers are employees, responsible for that. Again, under the same principles as piercing the corporate veil, those items are also eligible for reimbursement. If you have wage claims that weren't paid, believing the shareholders, officers, and directors could end up getting nailed for it. If you've had a situation where the corporation was used as a sham, those things could be done too. Okay? A corporation is liable for the activities of its agents, officers, and board members. To give you an example, if I'm driving down the road for Bob's Donuts, I drive a donut car, I drive that and plow into a school bus, and somebody gets hurt, they can sue not only me as the driver, but they can also sue Bob's Donuts as the owner of the vehicle, as my employee in Bob's Donuts turned around and did that, the corporation is responsible. So not only can they sue the driver, they can sue the corporation. Okay? Similarly, if directors or officers or employees are doing something that is illegal with the knowledge, consent, and oversight of the corporation can also be held for criminal responsibility as well as the individuals themselves. Okay? So if all of a sudden we decide at Bob's Donuts, we're going to turn it into Bob's Cocaine Shop, guess what? I know, not very much. I'm probably the only person in my generation that never smoked marijuana either, but anyway, that's upset. We turn around and do some kind of illegal activity, guess what? The officers, boards, and directors can be not only criminally responsible for that, but so can the corporation itself. And under New York State law, if you engage in a criminal activity as a corporation, the Attorney General can dissolve your corporation. That's one of the remedies you have. They can turn around and vaporize. Goodbye. Okay? So if you're doing something naughty, they can go after you as well. Okay. Any questions? Let's talk a little bit about liability and malpractice. We talked a little bit about this when we talked about professional corporations.
You cannot form a professional corporation for the purposes of insulating yourself from malpractice. The fact that I get together with a bunch of my physician friends and form Doctors at Your Call PC, if I turn around and cut off your right arm instead of your left arm that I was supposed to cut off, you can still sue the corporation and all of its employees, officers, directors, and everybody involved for malpractice. Okay? You can't insulate yourself from that. That's not where the limited liability comes in. What the liability comes in for is if they buy a new building and can't afford it, and the corporation goes under, guess what? That's a limitation on liability because they didn't make as much money as they wanted to. If you turn around and have somebody slip and fall on We Are Doctors PC, guess what? That too can be a limitation of liability, but malpractice cannot be. What is malpractice? Malpractice involves a standard of care that is incumbent with the profession and the standard practices of that profession within what is called the ambit of ordinary care. So if I'm a doctor, what we look at is what is professional practices of doctors require as far as the standard standards. If I get everything that a person of my standard medical training would do in that situation, I'm not liable for malpractice. If, however, I went into the operating room and I was highly intoxicated and turned around and made a mistake, guess what? That is malpractice. If I didn't follow the standards of care that every other doctor and my physician did, I could be responsible for malpractice. If most doctors in my profession turn around and read the New England Journal of Medicine on a weekly basis to ensure that everything as far as the medications they prescribe are up to date, I read the physician's desk reference to ensure that this drug has not been taken off the market. I've done everything I need to do, and I still had a problem where somebody was injured or died. I'm not going to be held liable. Whereas if I didn't do those things, and all of a sudden I gave you a drug which appeared in the physician's desk reference, don't mix it with this other one, and you had a reaction, guess what? You could probably sue me and recover a malpractice. Same goes through with law. If I turn around and miss the statute of limitations on a lawsuit, if I turn around and do not provide the level of care that an ordinary lawyer would, you could sue me for malpractice. Okay. You breach that duty of care. An action for medical malpractice in New York State, 2.5 years statute of limitations. There is what is known as the discovery rule. If the physician turns around and leaves the sponge in you, and you don't know about that for 6 years, the 2.5 years starts when you discover the sponge. Okay? Or some other form. Doesn't include when the alien's out. With respect to law or other professional malpractice, such as accountant's malpractice, engineering malpractice, that is deemed a breach of contract. Statute of limitations is 6 years in New York. There's a shortened one for medical malpractice because it's been so prolific, and as a result, that is 2.5 years. Okay. Medical liability is viewed as a tort. When you're talking about law or those other items, breach of contract is where legal malpractice lies. That's the difference. Okay? Generally, malpractice in the context of medical is viewed as a tort. Liability to third parties, where you have no privity of contract, that means you had no individual direct relationship.
third parties may sue an accountant for malpractice. That is not true for all malpractice, but with respect to accountants, it is. So if I make a mistake within the standards of accepted practice as an accountant, and it injures a third party, guess what? I can sue. To give you an example, I'm an accountant for General Electric Company, and my mistake causes General Electric Company to lose millions of dollars. Can the shareholders of JE, with whom I had no contract with me, turn around and sue you? Yes, you can. Okay? There's no privity of contract there, but they can do that. Liability is evaluated by the privity rule. First, they look to see if that is the case. Generally, third parties are not allowed, but in certain cases with accountant liability, they are. Okay? Contract, did you have a contract with that person? I personally believe the privity and contract are hard to settle. Privity means you have a direct relationship with the party with whom you are suing. So if I'm a lawyer, you're going to be my client. Okay? You had a direct relationship. That also means you have privity with it. Okay? Contractual liability and privity, I think, are pretty much the same thing. Some courts are starting after Sarbanes-Oxley, where they put in a whole bunch of requirements on accountants. Got to swap out people on engagements after a period of time. You have to ensure that there's no conflicts of interest. Conflicts are not always easily foreseeable because they can be prospective. You haven't even seen them yet. But when you talk about these things, some courts have started to use a flexible concept rather than the privity concept. That privity concept is much more easy to understand. You had a direct relationship with General Electric Company. You were their accountant, and you messed up something that cost them money. Yes, GE could sue you. When you're talking about a flexibility concept, all of a sudden, somebody who's buying GE light bulbs and they weren't manufactured right can turn around and sue you. I think that that's not strong legal reasoning, but there is a movement under law to try and provide more flexibility for malpractice. It's a pendulum, folks. It goes back and forth. Every day in my job as a counsel of state legislature, I see bills that want to open up malpractice, and I see bills that want to close it down. The problem with these malpractice suits, I'll be perfectly candid with you, is that they cost. Because even though you're recovering things, what happens is the companies don't end up paying for them. They just raise the cost of the product, so everybody else does. Okay? Generally, these things should be handled much more out of a suit for breach of contract rather than malpractice. If you're an accountant and not doing a good job, or a lawyer and not doing a good job, and we're not talking about medical malpractice now, but on a contractual basis, don't use that person, try and recoup the money for them, whatever you're going to do on that, but to sue them in malpractice tends to only reward the lawyers, in my opinion. Damn. Okay. An accountant is guilty of fraud. The intended victim of the fraud can turn around and sue if they are, even though privity of the contract is lacking if it affects them. If an accountant incidentally, to give you an example, turns around and falsifies an annual report, a shareholder which does not have privity of contract with that person, they never made a contract with them, could turn around and sue that accountant as a result of malpractice because it's fraud. They defrauded. It's really not a case of malpractice, because there's no standard of care that
shareholder. What it is an action of fraud. You defrauded me. You worked with that corporation to cook the books. I bought their stock because of the cookbooks. You owe me money.
There have been several major Big Four accounting firms that have got to go through these types of lawsuits. One of the most famous ones was involving the Knoxville World's Fair, and it involved an accounting firm that turned around and changed annual reports with respect to some of these World's Fair operators. With respect to that, they had to pay absolutely billions of dollars as a result. Sarbanes-Oxley started to regulate these things, as we said. It imposes significant liability on auditing firms for fraud, securities violations, and obstruction of justice. A lot of big penalties under Sarbanes-Oxley. It promoted auditor independence, as we discussed before. If you're a public company, and it only applies to public companies, this does not apply when you're an auditor for Bob Solex. If you're an auditor on a publicly traded corporation, you're subject to this. You have to change. You have to ensure that there's auditor independence. Now, I think what was that?
If you're an auditor, I think it's very hard to be independent because you are working on a contractual basis for that company.
You want to be rehired by that company. Indeed, you have a fiduciary duty to do good work for that company. There's a lot of judgment calls that go on this. It is very hard here because what in one person's mind should be, hey, company, don't do this, it's a very bad idea, is another person's, well, you know, they're taking a risk on it. It's a very difficult judgment call. We want auditor independence, but at the end of the day, it's a tough call to do. Okay. A lot of wiggle room here. One of the things Sarbanes-Oxley did is it requires all accountants that work on these publicly traded companies to register with the Accounting Oversight Board. It created this huge board, federal bureaucracy, to be able to oversee them. And you have to report regularly on your activities to it. We talked about Ira Milstein. He was one of the people who helped put this together. He talks about corporate audit committees, that a board of directors ought to have a committee that talks about how we work with the auditors. These audits can be enormous. They can be multi-year projects. They can be every year project. Okay? You talk about record retention. You know, Arthur Anderson got into a big issue with respect to that. Okay. Any questions?
Let's move on to something important.
Who wants to come down and see me?